the community of equus is the default position. So unless and the parties agree otherwise, their community, their property, sorry, will be regulated by community of equists.
And when we say that the community of equists regulates the marriage, what are the implications? So if I were to get married tomorrow, welcome to episode 14 of Fennec and Fennec's Law Boot, today's podcast discussing in particular property and family law and analyzing the best practices. With me, Nick De Bono, and my colleague, Dr. Maria Camilleri. Hi, Mar. Good
Hi.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Ready to go on a very sensitive topic in family law. So basically, what we will be discussing today is how one can acquire property, sell property, and transfer property, and the implications this can have throughout marriage, throughout a relationship with a partner, and the implications this may bring.
We shall be starting off this discussion by entering into the topic of ownership of property. Dr. Nick will be entering into the various aspects of property law and how property can be owned. So go ahead.
Exactly. Basically, obviously, we have different types of property to start with, Mar, where one can have an immovable property, so something which is fixed, and which, as the term implies, obviously, is all that can, without alteration to its substance, be moved from one place to another. Obviously, you can have things which are owned in a private nature or a publicly owned property, but obviously for the purposes of this podcast, we'll be referring to things that are owned privately, and property which can be acquired and derived by private individuals. There are many modes of acquisition that one can acquire property, so either by sale, by donation, by succession, so by inheritance. And obviously, each mode of acquisition has different implications in terms of that relationship with the partner, or in this case, with the husband or the wife, if there's a marriage. So as a baseline, we have things which can be owned by just one party in a marriage, so by either the husband or the wife. But then we could also have a state where property is owned in common, so by both the parties to a marriage, or even by more than one party. So you could have two people in a marriage owning a particular property conjointly with other persons. And so obviously this type of dynamic creates a bit of an issue or confusion in terms of what rights or obligations one can have in that state of ownership. However, when you break it down, there are obviously different obligations and implications, which we will obviously be discussing in terms today with full focus in terms of marriage. Mar, can you explain maybe the matrimonial regimes that regulate property and the implications that one can have when acquiring property in marriage?
Okay, yes. So first of all, we need to discuss the fact that in Malta, the default position upon marriage is that the property of a married couple is regulated by the community of equists. So, after marriage, there are three main matrimonial regimes. The first being the community of equists. There's also the community of residue under separate administration and the separation of estates.
Going into particularly the community of equists, what is this, the first of all, is this the default position at law? And what does one have to do to regulate or deregulate this state of community?
So marriage celebrated in Malta in the absence of an agreement to the contrary by a public deed produces ipso iure the community of equis. So yes, in sum, it means that the community of equis is the default position. So unless and the parties agree otherwise, their community, their property, sorry, will be regulated by community of equists.
And when we say that the community of equists regulates the marriage, what are the implications? So if I were to get married tomorrow, my property and my income derived through marriage, what are the implications to that?
Yes, if I were to quote the law, Article 132 of the Civil Code lists what comprises the community of equists. In fact, starting with the first point, all that is acquired by each of the spouses by exercise of his or her work or industry is part of the community of equists.
So when we talk about salaries, for example, that would be included.
Exactly, salaries and any other form of income.
So if I had to go and purchase a property or acquire a share in a property whilst I am married and have the state and the regime regulating my marriage of the community of equis, what are the implications if the property is just acquired in my name and not in my husband's or wife's name?
So if the property is acquired during marriage, it is automatically part of the community of equis. So it is the property of both spouses. In fact, by default, the law provides that all property each spouse possesses is deemed part of the equists unless it came to either spouse anterior to marriage. This we will enter into even further in our discussion.
Okay, so obviously that has quite a large implication on persons who acquire property when in a community of equists. What are the other situations that one needs to look out for in terms of being in the community of equists and acquiring property during this state of marriage?
Of importance is the fact that when property is acquired by one of the spouses via succession or donation or any other title, the property itself would belong to the spouse concerned, but the fruits which derive from that property would be comprised in the community of equists. What do I mean by fruits? By fruits, I mean if the property is rented out, then the rental income from the property would then be part of the community of equists.
So even if I would have acquired the property through different means, so not purchasing, but for example, through inheritance, would all that I derive from that property, although it being mine solely, also have to be split with my partner in marriage?
Yes, in fact, the law states that the fruits of the property of each of the spouses comprises the community of equists. So whatever is derived from property owned by one party belongs to both parties and would eventually need to be split between the two.
Because obviously one of the parties would have a share of those fruits. Are there any other things that comprise the community of equists? So in terms of what people could look out for when entering into a marriage and dealing with certain property transactions or acquisitions?
An interesting note is that property acquired with monies which either of the spouses possessed since before the marriage, or the money had come to them by donation or succession, would also fall under the community of equists. So if I inherited a sum of money, and I believe that sum of money is solely mine, and rightly so, because it's not part of the community of equists, if I decide to purchase any movable or immovable property with that money, the item purchased will no longer be solely mine, but I will have to divide it with my spouse. So meaning both of us would be owners of that property.
In that case. Interesting to note that obviously this has a major implication on what people do with their property. In fact, on this point, I wanted to maybe make a distinction here between what is considered as paraphernal property and what is not considered as paraphernal property.
Paraphernal property is property which was acquired by the spouse prior to marriage, whereas any property which the spouse acquires after marriage would comprise the community of equis, as we have noted.
What we just mentioned now. So in the case that one, for example, inherited prior to marriage, there would be absolutely no risk in terms of the community of equis, because that person would have acquired that property or that movable prior to marriage. Obviously, as all things legal, this requires a certain level of proof in everything you do. So it's always advisable that one would keep kind of proof that he has acquired that object or that immovable prior to marriage.
Yes, we have to also keep in mind that if the property is used as the matrimonial home, there are also other implications in law. Maybe Dr. Nick, you can elaborate on this point.
For sure. So apart from the fact that we just discussed ownership, the law also gives us a clear definition of what the matrimonial home is. And also there's a lot of jurisprudence regarding this matter. Irrespective of which party actually holds the ownership of the property, whether received prior to marriage, whether acquired during marriage, the matrimonial home is the place of residence where the spouses would reside with their family. The law places certain obligations and implications on the matrimonial home in terms of how one party or another can be kind of evicted from that property because of a dispute or because of an eventual separation or divorce. So one cannot just wake up one fine morning and say, listen, this is my house and I want to kick out my partner because of a dispute. So if the property has been the matrimonial home for the parties throughout a certain number of years, then this obviously is considered as the matrimonial home, and both spouses, irrespective of whether they own the property or not, would have the right to reside in the property, obviously until the separation or the eventual divorce is concluded.
It is also interesting to note that there are instances at law where, or if the spouse owns the property but was of fault in bringing about the separation, so if the spouse committed adultery or domestic violence and he is of danger to the family, it could be the case that the court orders that that spouse who owned the property does not continue to reside in the matrimonial home.
So over there, obviously, there's an implication on terms of ownership as well. So it doesn't mean just by having ownership, you are guaranteed residence in that property. Interesting to note, obviously, Mara, I know we're going into a lot of different topics here, but so that our listeners can follow clearly. To close off onto the community of equis subject.
Yes. Firstly, there exist other matrimonial regimes which the parties can choose to apply for prior or even during marriage. But more importantly, if spouses believe that they do not want the community of equis to regulate their marriage immediately, they could start off by preparing a prenuptial agreement before the notary, because the law requires that this is done by public deed, wherein they specifically choose any other regime. They can't just invent any formula of how their property is going to be regulated, but they need to choose any one of the other matrimonial regimes which we have mentioned. Lastly, to close off on the community of Equest topic, can you enter into the implications when one of the spouses enters into any debts?
Yes. Obviously, as we said before, we have the community of Equest, which obviously brings certain rights to both of the parties. But with every right, there's also an obligation. And these obligations could also be vis-a-vis any debts which are incurred by any of the spouses. So although that you can have a state of community with your spouse in terms of the property that is acquired during marriage, if one of the spouses incurs debts throughout this state of community, then the law is very clear and there's absolutely no doubt about this, that any debts that are incurred by one of the parties will have to be borne also by the other spouse. This obviously means that the personal debts of each spouse are chargeable on all of the community of the property between the spouses, but there are obviously caveats to this point, and it doesn't mean that one of the spouses can go incur all the debts that he can think of and then expect his other partner to share the burden. Mar, what type of caveats are there to this default position in the law?
The law, in fact, provides that when an act which requires the consent of both parties is performed only by one without the consent of the other, that spouse may go to court and ask for that act to be annulled. However, if the act performed is a normal act of management of a trade, business, or profession exercised by that spouse, then that spouse would have an exception, in the sense that since it's a normal act of trade, then the spouse would be allowed to have performed that act on his own accord.
And the other spouse would be protected in terms of the liabilities?
Well, with respect to liabilities, then there's the possibility of requesting an exclusion, whether generally or limitedly, from the administration of the community of Equists. This is done at the request of one of the spouses, obviously against the other, and it can be requested in two instances. When one of the spouses is not competent to administer, or when he has already mismanaged the community. These obviously will entail providing sufficient proof in court for this behavior, but
it's very clear that in the community of Equists there are quite a lot of things that you should look out for, because what can be done by one of the spouses can have major implications on the other spouse. On this point, to close off this part of the podcast, what other regimes, apart from the community of Equists, can apply? So if I want to deregulate from the community of Equists, I know we mentioned them in the beginning, but maybe we can go through them for the benefit of our listeners.
So there's the community of residue under separate administration. This must be agreed to by means of a marriage contract, and it implies that acquisitions made by each spouse during marriage is held and administered by the spouse who acquired it, whereas the property which is acquired jointly is administered jointly. Therefore, this regime places responsibility on each spouse to take care of their own assets. This regime is terminated either by mutual consent of the parties or by the authority of the court. What is interesting to note is that upon termination, what happens is that both parties place everything in a pot, basically, which is referred to as the final residue, where one spouse will show all debts and acquisitions, and the other spouse will do the same thing. and the spouse with the greater residue must share from its residue in order to bring an equal share of the assets and debts, basically. So each party gets an equal share at the end of the termination of the regime, as well as obviously the termination of the marriage.
So just to clarify this point, it is a separate administration. So there are no state of community between the parties, in the sense that if I acquire property, like we mentioned before, during marriage, my partner, my spouse, would not have ownership rights on that property, but would have the right of residue on termination of that regime.
Exactly.
What about the other, which obviously touches upon this, the other regime of the separate administration, which is the complete separate administration of assets?
Well, this regime is quite clear and simple, in the sense that each party retains the property that is acquired solely in their name. This also applies to fruits which derive from the property, and therefore there will only be a state of community, so to speak, if the parties decide to acquire property jointly. So they will both be co-owners of the said property. Otherwise, property acquired in their name will pertain to the individual who acquired it.
Excellent. So that kind of closes the chapter on matrimonial regimes and how property is administered and regulated in marriage. On this point, there's a lot of people who speak about post and prenuptial agreements, kind of threatening their partner when they manage that I'm going to come with a prenup or a postnup. What are these agreements and how are they regulated under Maltese law?
Yes, that's quite a common concern, in fact. Future spouses can enter into any agreement as long as this is not contrary to morals or inconsistent with the law. And this agreement would principally be eliminating the community of equists. The wish of the parties needs to be expressed in a public deed, and it will only be operative against third parties if this deed is eventually registered in the public registry. In such agreements, what usually happens is that the spouses either go for the community of residue of separate administration or for the separation of estates.
In fact, I wanted to ask you, what is the main difference? So it seems like it's kind of very similar to the separation of estates. What is the difference between the two?
In reality, there's no difference. The prenuptial agreement is the means by which the parties decide to opt for the separation of estates. Once the parties decide to do so, they can make variations or even counter declarations within the prenuptial agreement. If these variations are done prior to marriage, then they must be made with the consent of all parties to the contract, whereas if the variations are done or are required after marriage, it needs to be done with the authority of the court and without prejudice to the rights of their children or to third parties.
Okay, so that's prior to the marriage. Now, in terms of post-nups, can that be done and in what manner?
Yes, a postnuptial agreement can be made between spouses, wherein in any period during marriage they can decide to terminate the community of equests and instead elect any other regime.
So similar to what we said, which we discussed in terms of moving away from the default position. Obviously, Mar, as you correctly explained, all this has a bit of bearing and context. What we discussed today, property in marriage, comes mainly into play when there is a dispute between the parties. And a dispute between the parties in marriage could, for various reasons, lead to different situations which can end up either in separation or in divorce. Obviously, in terms of the property that is co-owned by the spouses, this kind of brings about a bit of an issue if the two spouses are going to lead a separate life and want to move away from each other. So in terms of terminating the community of equis that they were possibly using to regulate their marriage before, and obviously going forward in terms of disposing of common property or separating common property, what are the general procedures that one needs to go through to get this done?
So at law, one can opt to terminate the community of equis pending separation proceedings, meaning during dependency of the court case being heard before a judge. I'm saying this because usually the termination of the community of equis occurs on final separation judgment. However, there might be instances where it is required that the community of equis is terminated beforehand.
And in those instances where it's meant to be terminated beforehand, what are the situations where the court can intervene in terms of a dispute? So whether I want to terminate this state, what options do I have to go to court to actually obtain the separation of property?
So judicial separation of property can be requested for various reasons, such as upon the interdiction or incapacitation of one of the spouses, when one spouse's disordered state of affairs or conduct in relation to the administration of equis jeopardizes the interests of the community of equis or the interests of the family, where one spouse fails in the duty to contribute to the needs of the family, where one spouse is excluded from the administration either generally or to a great extent. So it wouldn't make sense for the spouses to remain in the community of property. And lastly, upon legal separation.
When you say upon legal separation, obviously there are proceedings that one needs to go through in terms of opening the separation. And on this point, it would be good to mention that separations generally are opened through, not generally, are opened always through a mediation. So that is the first step that one must take. This obviously kickstarts the process in terms of actually dividing the common property that is held in the community of equis, and would put both parties at a table where they have to come to an agreement on how they are to split the estate that they were holding in common during marriage. Obviously, this doesn't always work, and the parties are generally afforded 8 sittings in a mediation so as to come to an amicable agreement on how they are going to divide the estate. If they do not come to this agreement and do not conclude the agreement within those 8 sittings, then the parties are referred by the mediator to the courts, where the courts would intervene and obviously divide the property, since there would not be an agreement on how this division is to take place. Obviously, at this stage, most of what was discussed during this podcast becomes relevant in terms of what was acquired during marriage, whether this was paraphernal or not, whether properties or incomes do pertain to the community of equis. So all what we have discussed throughout this podcast has an implication also mainly in when the parties come to separate the estate. That is why generally it is always advisable for the parties to be aware of the regime that regulates their marriage so that they can avoid surprises when they come to separate their estates with their spouse. This obviously is not an easy thing to do. It generally relies on a load of proof that one needs to bring forward to the courts to prove that certain payments were made from paraphernal property, for example, or that certain things were not included in the community of equis, which therefore gives the court a bit of a more clearer picture of what needs to be separated between the parties. Apart from the personal separation that we're discussing post-2011, we had the introduction of divorce, and that is kind of the final step after separating the estate. In terms of divorce, this does not per se have an effect on separation if you already separated, because the separation generally, separation agreement generally deals already with the separation of the estates. So the divorce would kind of only have an implication in terms of remarrying another person. But Mara, I don't know if you can run us through what implications divorce can have if parties opt to go straight for a divorce in terms of property administration.
Well, in the divorce, if the parties had not drafted a separation agreement or there was no separation judgment regulating the division of their common property, would need to enter into this division exercise. The courts in divorce usually aim at closing off any pendencies between the parties which would not have been concluded in separation. And obviously, if the separation would not have been done prior to the divorce, then every aspect of the spouse's marriage would need to be discussed, such as current custody of the children, access of the two parties to their children, the issue of maintenance towards the spouses and towards their children, who will be residing in their matrimonial home, and finally, how the community property will be divided.
Obviously, this has a bit of a relation towards the way one plans their estate. What we discussed today, I think, has a clear implication on how one would regulate the future state of their marriage and in terms of what they want out of that marriage. I think this obviously has a big part in how one decides whether to take on the community of acquis as the regime which regulates the marriage or not. Obviously, we saw clearly that the community of acquis brings about a lot of obligations on both the spouses, and that it's not as easy as one would think to just get married and think things can be easily divided at the end, because this would always entail a lot of evidence, a lot of valuations, expenses that are all related to what happened in the marriage, whether it was a short marriage or whether it was a long marriage. So it is always advisable to know what one is going into before, because unfortunately, as is kind of common nowadays, these things happen and marriages do not always last forever. So the spouses should be aware of what they are going to enter into in terms of their property and all the things they own, and what they could be liable to in terms of property and what they owe to third parties, because the implications of being in a marriage are not just simply love implications, but also have an effect on the property you own or sell in this case. Just to wrap up, Mara, I don't know if you have any more concluding remarks in terms of property in family law and how one can be aware of any of the many loopholes or things that might not be so common to the listeners hearing us today, for them to protect their estates and protect their property.
Yes, I would recommend that especially parties who are still in the process of preparing for their married life to seek legal advice if they have any questions or are in doubt as to what will happen to their property after marriage, as it is always best to discuss and reach an agreement when you're in a healthy relationship, as opposed to when, unfortunately, a marriage breaks down and you would need to discuss all your property issues in a very
heated sitting.
Exactly, with your lawyers. So ideally,
it makes it obviously more easy when things are a bit calmer and people can kind of discuss the way forward. Obviously, that kind of brings us to wrapping up today's podcast, where we ran through basically the most important points relating to property in family law. Obviously, this podcast serves to just give an overview of most of the important things that one should look out for or one could opt for, but is not intended to give personal advice. And obviously, as Maria rightly said, you should always contact your lawyer to discuss the best way forward so that you can be really protected in whatever situation you might find yourself in. That's why obviously these things are dealt with on a case-by-case basis, and some things might not apply to you directly or indirectly. It's good to note that one must be aware of the implications, because as we explained, there are obligations that exist in marriage. It's not only rights that you can acquire, and that was the main focus of this podcast, to just make people aware that when entering into a marriage and regulating the regime that can affect your property, one should always have an idea of the implications that different actions or different decisions may affect your property in marriage. Thank you, Maria, for a very, very interesting podcast.
Thank you.
The listeners really enjoyed it as much as we did. And we hope that you'll tune in for the next episode of Fennec & Fennec's Law Boot. Thank you.